From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. A Milwaukee Journal Sentinel investigation turns up some alarming inconsistencies in the way newborns are screened and tested. We'll talk with a lead reporter.
One of the things that I do in my job as an investigative reporter is data analysis. And so this was a really good opportunity to use data to figure out what's actually going on.
Then we'll mark the 150th anniversary of the Gettysburg Address with our Civil War contributor. While SAS Gerrianne Hazlett takes issue with many of the ways the country has marked the Civil War's sesquicentennial. And a neurosurgeon says his own traumatic experience exposed him to a spiritual insight. He says the afterlife.
I made a full and complete recovery within probably 2 or 3 months, which was inexplicable from a medical standpoint. And then I had to explain this incredible odyssey that I had deep within coma.
Lake Effect comes your way next after the news from NPR and Milwaukee Public Radio. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. It's been routine for years in this country that newborn babies are screened for a variety of diseases and conditions shortly after they're born. But an investigative series concluding today in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel learned that the way those screening tests are handled is anything but routine. The series found delays in the process that have led to serious medical issues and even deaths in some infants from conditions that could have been successfully treated if they'd been caught early. The stories also pointed to significant holes in the data that are available, making it difficult to quantify the problem in some states. Ellen Gabler is an investigative reporter for the Journal Sentinel, and she was the lead reporter for the series. She told Lake Effect's Mitch Teich what led the paper to look into screening test delays in the first place.
Well, one of our reporters, Mark Johnson, heard about a child in Wisconsin whose test had been delayed, and the child had gotten extremely sick. The baby had a condition that, if caught early, could be easily treated with a simple diet of sugar water, essentially.
Well, and so that got you thinking, maybe this isn't the only time this has happened. I wonder how many times it has happened.
Well, what happened was we started looking around, and we saw that on the websites of many state public health labs, there was a warning to quickly send these samples in. So several of the websites said, do not batch samples, and that means don't hold them and wait and send them in groups. And so when we saw it, you know, in Arizona, we saw it in Texas, we saw it in all these different – on these different websites, and we thought, if they're giving that much of a warning, there could be something going on.
This is really the case of we really have no idea if this is a big problem. Let's take a look at it.
Exactly. And one of the things that I do in my job as an investigative reporter is data analysis. And so this was a really good opportunity to use data to figure out what's actually going on.
Well, before we get to how you crunch the data, tell us about how newborn screening works. People who have had a baby in recent years are probably familiar with the quick blood test. It is a heel prick, but what happens then?
Well, so newborn screening is amazing, actually. So almost every child born in the entire country is tested for these genetic disorders shortly after birth. They, as you said, they prick the baby's heels, they take the blood sample, and they send it to the lab. They're supposed to send the blood sample to the lab within 24 hours of collection. The whole way that newborn screening works is the state lab does the testing quickly, or they're supposed to, and then they contact the doctor. And so if the child has one of these genetic disorders, they can be treated quickly.
And is it national guidelines for how the testing should play out, or does each state have its own guidelines?
Well, that's where it gets a little bit complicated. There's no set standard that has to happen. There are recommendations. In some states, there are regulations about how quickly the tests have to be sent. Some states have actual regulations that say you must send this test within 24 hours of collection. However, what we found is that's often not followed.
And often these are very rare conditions that they're testing for.
Individually, these conditions are rare, but collectively there are many of them. About one in every 800 children is born with a potentially severe or deadly condition that can be treated and managed if the child is properly tested.
Well, so then explain how you set up this story, what you set out to measure.
We wanted to see how many tests were being delayed, and we wanted to look at the entire country. So what we did, we spoke with experts. I spoke with state labs and asked, you know, how they track this. And what I ended up requesting testing data from every single state in the country and the District of Columbia. And it was very interesting because at first, all of the labs were very hesitant to give us anything. You know, we certainly weren't asking for any identifying information. This was just basic data that would allow me to get a sense of what the delays were in from when the hospital collected the sample to when it arrived at the lab. But the state labs were very hesitant to release it.
And in the end, you looked at how many hospitals, I guess it was, took two or fewer days to have these samples tested and how many took more than 5 days?
One of the interesting things about this story was the labs don't keep their data in any standard way. And so what we had to determine was how can we look at this in as standard a way as possible? And when I spoke with lab directors, many of them said what they considered was a late or delayed sample was anything 5 days or after. Federal recommendations actually say that samples should take no longer than 3 days, but we use 5 days in most cases.
Right. There are a number of infants whose stories you tell, and they're really heartbreaking stories, where after 3 days, it became a real issue.
Yes. Some of these children get extremely sick within a couple days of birth. We have a story coming out today that reporter John Fauber wrote where a child born in Colorado actually died the day before his newborn screening results came back.
And in fact, there's a comparison, I guess, to another child who had the same issue whose test was done in an efficient manner and is fine.
Exactly. And those children have a condition where their blood sugar can basically drop. And if the parent doesn't know that the child has this condition, the child can just die. If they do know, however, it's pretty easy to treat this condition. They just regularly feed the child. And so, you know, they wake them up every 2 hours and feed them. And that can be the matter of life or death.
What were the most common reasons that you found for delays?
There's a lot of reasons why samples are delayed. Probably the first is that the hospitals just weren't paying attention to either the regulations in their state or the recommendations. Like I said, some states have actual state regulations that say you must send these samples within 24 hours, but a lot of hospitals just didn't do it.
You mentioned the idea of batching. Was that a fairly common issue?
Yes, and what's interesting about that is so many of these state public health labs and health departments tell hospitals, do not batch. They have warnings that say this can lead to irreversible damage or death in infants. But still, some hospitals are doing it anyway.
Oh, and another issue that you write about that seemed amazing on its face was that many labs just weren't open on the weekends.
Yes, about half the labs in the country are closed on the weekends. And so that means that if a child is born later in the week, their test will not be tested as quickly. And again, you know, a matter of days is really – a matter of hours, actually, can be very crucial.
What about the cost of getting samples to the labs for testing?
So it's different in every state. Some states, again, require that samples are sent by courier or overnight mail. In some states, the state lab pays for that service. In some states, the hospitals have to pay for it themselves. We actually found some cases where even when the state pays for the courier service – hospitals were still sending the samples through the U.S. mail.
You write that as you crunched the numbers, your numbers actually for how prevalent this was nationwide were actually a bit conservative.
Yes, that goes back to this issue of there not being any real federal standard that all states adhere to. Like I said, federal recommendations say these samples should take no longer than 3 days to get to the state lab. We had to actually use 5 days as our standard. That was because of the way that a lot of the data was provided to us. You know, I think I mentioned this, but we really did have a very difficult time getting this information from a lot of states. In fact, we still haven't gotten it from 24 states. But in some cases, they would only provide it in, you know, 5 days or longer or 6 days or longer. So we tried to find the most common metric to measure all the states by.
Were there examples of hospitals or states that recognized a problem and actually did something about it?
Definitely. A lot of hospitals do a great job with newborn screening. And, you know, there are several states, too, that do a pretty good job. Iowa in particular, they have a very sophisticated, and actually it's not even that sophisticated, it's just very well run. Their system is very well run.
As you did the reporting for this piece, was it evident that this issue, the issue of delays in newborn screening, was on anyone's radar screen but yours?
Some advocacy groups had said that this was a problem. This was something they were concerned about. What was interesting was I don't think anybody had really ever tried to figure out how big of a problem it was. And as we got farther and farther along in the reporting, I realized that some of the labs had never even done this analysis. So many of these labs didn't even know what particular hospitals were a problem, and they didn't know how big the problem was in their own state. Arizona is one in particular. They're going to be having a statewide training for all of their hospitals to remind them how to properly handle newborn screening samples. It was actually kind of the same story here in Wisconsin and Texas and others.
Well, let's talk about Wisconsin because it's an interesting study. First of all, you report it was the last of the states that actually allowed you access to data. What were the state's reasons for keeping the lid on the results?
We requested this data from the Wisconsin State Lab of Hygiene in June, and it got released to us about a week and a half ago. They initially said they didn't want to release the information because it was adversarial to the hospitals. And if you go online, you can see we list hospital by hospital, you know, the track record of individual hospitals. And they felt that that information was, first of all, adversarial, and secondly, that the public wouldn't understand necessarily that not every late sample means a child is being harmed. And that is true. You know, it only matters if your child has one of the conditions, but you just don't know if your child has the condition.
Well, and that's a good point. I mean, is there any way to know for sure how many of these delays resulted in harm to children?
There is not. And part of that is because we can't get the names of the children who were tested, and we can't get the outcome of the test, which would be a clear violation of privacy. So we focused on the information that, you know, would not violate anybody's privacy.
But one of the things that struck me as interesting was the hospitals themselves seemed to sing a different tune when you brought this data to them.
Exactly. Many of the hospitals we contacted after the information was released said that they had no idea of their performance. And they were actually, they told us they were very grateful that we brought this to their attention. Aurora Healthcare, in effect, you know, made changes right away. Their courier had not been delivering newborn screening samples to the state lab on Saturdays. And so as soon as we notified them about this, they said, look, we're looking into this problem. We're going to explore it further, but right away we're going to make this change and we're going to deliver samples on Saturdays.
Well, and Wisconsin's lab is open Monday through Saturday, is that right?
That's correct.
Talk about how Wisconsin fares versus other states.
Wisconsin's record overall is pretty good compared to a lot of states, but pretty good in a lot of cases isn't good enough, especially if your child is the one who has a condition and that condition was missed because a test was delayed. And again, you know, it varies a lot among hospitals. And so you can go, again, you can go online and kind of explore the data yourself, but some hospitals do a great job and then others don't.
For people that want to take this a step further, what are the kinds of interactive features that they can take advantage of?
We wanted to make sure that people could get as much information as possible. And in an issue like this, it's important that the information is available to the public. And so we did a couple different things. We have a site where you can see the differences in all the state labs in the country. So you can see if your lab is open on the weekends or closed on the weekends. You can see what the shipping requirements are. Again, like I said, some states require a courier. Some just let hospitals mail the samples in through the U.S. mail. And then for each state, you can see whether or not your state released the data or if they didn't release the data. If they didn't release the data, we have contact information where you can contact important public health officials in that state to urge them to release the data. And then in states where we did receive the information, you can search by hospitals and explore which hospitals have a good track record and which could use some work.
Ellen Gabler, thanks so much for sharing the story with us.
Thanks for having me.
Ellen Gabler is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and the lead reporter on the paper's series Deadly Delays, which wraps up in today's edition of the paper. The two other reporters on the series were Mark Johnson and John Fauber. Gabler spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke. And you can find a link to the full series and interactive features that accompany it at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. One of the defining speeches in American history was delivered 150 years ago today. We'll learn more about the Gettysburg Address when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. We're back with Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. 150 years ago today, President Abraham Lincoln delivered the Gettysburg Address. It's become Lincoln's most famous speech and is one of American history's best known as well. It's only 272 words and lasts about 2 minutes, but since there's no extant recording of Lincoln giving the speech, we've enlisted Lake Effect's Civil War contributor Thomas Martin Sabatke.
47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. Now we are engaged in a great civil war, testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. We are met on a great battlefield of that war. We have come to dedicate a portion of that field as a final resting place for those who here gave their lives that that nation might live. It is altogether fitting and proper that we should do this. But in a larger sense, we cannot dedicate, we cannot consecrate, we cannot hallow this ground. The brave men, living and dead, who struggled here have consecrated it far above our poor power to add or to detract. The world will little note nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion, that we here highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall have a new birth of freedom, and that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
While it may be one of American history's best-known speeches, there's a lot that isn't commonly known about the context in which it was delivered, as Sabatke tells Lake Effect's Stephanie Lecce.
What you have is 15,000 people descend on Gettysburg to be there for the speechifying on this day, and they don't have enough room for them. Here you have 2,500 people in a town, and then 15,000 people come to visit. And unlike the soldiers who will just lie on a hillside and get their sleep and eat something, these people expect to be in beds and to live in a civilized fashion as they visit the great site of this great battle. And here, Edward Everett, the greatest orator in the North, probably in the whole country, give a two-hour oration. And the president to get some remarks. David Wills, one of the most prominent attorneys in Adams County, Pennsylvania, where it's the county seat there, invited both Everett, and he accepted, and the president, as he put it, to make a few remarks, not any great oration, but to be there and to make a few remarks. David Wills, who has it's a large house that's still there in Gettysburg on what's called the Diamond or the Square, and it's you can actually tour parts of it now as a museum. It's wonderfully been restored. Mrs. Wills was pregnant well along, so you can imagine in her confinement she didn't want these people coming in. They had 38 lodgers the night before the speech, 38, and they had people doubled and tripled up in beds. The only two guests in the whole Wills house, and these were where all the top politicos went to stay, to get their own beds were Everett and the president. It's kind of like, well, you're not going to make the president, have to kind of get in with two or three other people that maybe he's never slept with before. These guys are the only two guys that get their own bed.
Why would so many people gather? Obviously, this huge battle occurred there months prior, but why would so many people turn out for the dedication of a cemetery?
Well, in Victorian times, you know, there were things like the good death, and people had immense respect for people who are grieving. We're 2 years into a great war, and nobody has gotten away with not seeing someone in grief for a lost loved one. And there's a sense and an understanding that the battle that last summer was a key turning point in that conflict. It's important. David Wills and people in the town of Gettysburg had bought land up on Cemetery Hill next to the Evergreen Cemetery, which was the town cemetery. And it was to be a national cemetery. And this is an independent effort, and it was working. They actually raised money, and they got the thing bought. And the government was going to come in, I think, and help along the way. And people wanted to be there because Edward Everett is a darn good orator. And they felt that this itself would be a remembered historic event beyond the battle months later in November. There was great interest, great excitement. There was a sense that because of Vicksburg that summer and Gettysburg in July of 63, that those might be turning points. There was great hope in the North that they had the upper hand. And there was a sense that this is something that you want to be there.
So this sounds like it was as much of a rally, if you will, to support the troops as it was to memorialize those who had been lost.
To some extent, that's true. Certainly all the ceremonies were very solemn. But the night before the speech, Lincoln does address a very enthusiastic crowd of maybe a couple of hundred people in the square right below him where the Wills House is today. And he made just a few remarks and a joke or two, and the crowd was happy. And I think they did. I think this is part of the excitement that, you know, this horrible war has gone on for 2 years, and now we think we've got the upper hand on the rebellion. And Lincoln said, basically, I've got the real thing is tomorrow, so let me make my speech tomorrow. And that's when he made some word changes. The last polish was done the night before, right before he went to bed. He actually was working on this speech quite hard, contrary to the idea that he just kind of did it on the fly. No, he actually had several, two or three different drafts that we're aware of. And he did not do any draft work on the speech on the train on the way, as much as I would love that to be true. The historians all agree that that was not the case. There's no information for that. The next day, it's very solemn. Because you asked a question about, is this more a celebration? But once they marched with troops and dignitaries up Baltimore Street, up to the hill on Cemetery Hill, when they gathered by the speaker's platform and got ready for the various parts of the ceremony that would open up and commemorate the opening up of this cemetery to the Union war dead who had sacrificed themselves for the nation. There was a burial party of a half a dozen people, and they were burying a number of corpses right next to this area. So I don't think those people would have been in a great mood. They would have been in an appropriately somber mood.
You point out a very interesting point, that this was a Union cemetery. And I wonder if that's something that gets lost in public memory today, that it wasn't Union and Confederate soldiers who were being memorialized in this cemetery. It really was for the Union side.
That's right. I mean, it wasn't something that people made a big deal about. But had they been pressed upon it back then, maybe somebody could come from our time and say, well, I'm glad we're honoring both sides, war dead, they'd be in trouble because this was to memorialize the people who fought and died to preserve the United States, not a Confederacy. So you've got that. Some of the people had to stand on freshly filled in graves to observe the speechifying. And there was a smell of death around the place. During that day, these 15,000 people went all over the battlefield looking around, and two additional corpses were found. and then identified. There were still parts of knapsacks and canteens, and not as much as there had been that summer and early fall, but there were still some things there. This was a town that still was grieving, and the evidence of the battle was still to be seen and smelled. It was real. It was palpable. And so that's the atmosphere, and you start with Edward Everett for 2 hours.
And so what did Edward Everett say in this speech that most people today didn't even know there was someone else speaking, and actually that President Lincoln wasn't the main speaker that day?
Well, Edward Everett mainly kind of gave a play-by-play replay of the exploits of the Union Army at Gettysburg and made direct allusions to ancient Greek history. And it was a really good, wonderful speech for what it was to do. And he did speak for almost 2 hours. In those days, you don't have all the things we have today to entertain ourselves. And so people's attention spans were very much longer, and they were very much more tolerant of that. Of course, we all know, and it is true, I think Everett wrote to Lincoln and said, "You accomplished in 2 minutes what I did in 2 hours, maybe not even that." You know, it was kind of a thing where I think Everett, who is a great orator and speechmaker, understood that Lincoln had made a great speech.
And so Lincoln takes the stage. Everett finishes up.
Right.
Lincoln takes the stage. Did people know what the president was going to say? Did they have any idea of the kinds of remarks, or did they have expectations for what they thought he might say?
Well, they certainly expected and got a very respectful honoring of the war dead that were being buried in this new national cemetery. But they had no idea of what direction his remarks would take, none whatsoever.
We know the words of the Gettysburg Address, but what is it that maybe we don't always hear?
Well, one of the things that I've encountered in working with students at the university level and teaching is the difficulty with the first couple of paragraphs. But he refers to that 87 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation. And, of course, the two things he identifies, that it was our country was conceived or begun in liberty, and it was dedicated to the proposition or devoted to the idea that all men are created equal. And then a couple lines later, he says that now we are engaged in a great civil war testing whether that nation or any nation so conceived and so dedicated can long endure. I think sometimes a bit of that is lost to the public today when I work with them on this. I've actually confronted students and members of the general public. And what he's really saying is, look, we are going to give this American democratic experiment a second chance. And the question that's really in front of the whole country is, can democracy work? Every other country on earth that time was either a partial monarchy or a dictatorial one. And all these princes and emperors and kings and queens and their aristocratic nobility surrounding them in all these European countries, they were pointing at the U.S. and telling their people, look, this is what happens when the masses of the people try to govern themselves. You need to be governed by people of a higher sort, by those who are in the elite. And Americans, North and South, actually, this is where that would come in, but especially Northerners who are preserving the Union. What's often lost is that these men that died there, they weren't just doing that at that point for some empty thing. They understood. Everybody there at that speech understood that we were defying the world by trying to continue a representative democracy in the face of a world that very few, if any, nations had. That's what Lincoln's talking about. He doesn't know. Lincoln is thinking, and this is true, Lincoln is thinking, if we don't win this war, the Union does not prevail. This is going to prove that our whole democratic experiment is a total failure.
But was he not also referring to enfranchising and freeing the slaves?
Yes. At the end of the speech, he, of course, talks about a new birth of freedom. And here, historians even today are somewhat divided about that. There are those that are the skeptics that say, well, no, he was talking about the Union gets that second chance. We're going to have a new birth of freedom because the Union's going to be preserved. And in being preserved, the Union is going to give you a chance to have your liberty in safety and to have a country where all men are created equal. But anyone in that place that heard those words or saw them reported in the press knew he was also thinking about 4 million slaves who were in the process day by day being freed by the hundreds of thousands and then millions by the time the war was over. People knew that if the Union won the war, 4 million slaves would be free men and women. That's going to be a direct consequence. So when he says a new birth of freedom, I don't go with the skeptics. As a historian, I am out front and I say everyone understood that that not only meant the Union and its liberties and freedoms would be preserved, our democratic experiment itself, but that a whole bunch of people were going to get their freedom for the first time.
Thomas Sabaki, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thomas Martin Sabaki is a historian, author, and educator. He's also our Civil War contributor. His latest book is Richmond's Bloody Road. Coming up next, a Lake Effect essayist thinks the country has some soul-searching to do when it comes to the Civil War. She'll explain what she means when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. Before the break, we marked the anniversary of the Gettysburg Address given by President Abraham Lincoln 150 years ago today. The sesquicentennial of the Civil War has been commemorated by many people in many ways, and much of it has made Lake Effect essayist Gerianne Haislett uncomfortable.
Civil War reenactment is a popular and even passionate avocation for many Americans. I don't like them, though. It wasn't until I heard historians this summer on WUWM's Lake Effect describing Wisconsin's role in the Battle of Gettysburg that I began to understand why. It is because of the glorification of war, the tales of epic courage, and of decimated ranks that continue to charge against tremendous odds, and the glossing over of the horrific lessons that brutal war should have taught us. Americans need to smell the stench of fields strewn with bloated bodies, view blown-off limbs and gangrenous wounds, feel the chest-constricting grief of families who lose loved ones, and wear the bodies of soldiers that are forever broken by combat. I grew up near the Confederate capital of Richmond, Virginia, imbued with Southern pride and the rebel motto of, "The South will rise again." We as Southerners flew our flag, erected statues of our generals, and demonized theirs. But as I gained experience and maturity, the more delusional and juvenile that defiance seemed, and I believed the South would eventually get over it. I was wrong. Not long ago, Texas Governor Rick Perry said Texans might want to escape federal government strictures by seceding from the Union. How maddening. I want to drag anyone who speaks so glibly to the cyclorama at Pennsylvania's Gettysburg Museum and Visitor Center, which depicts that bloody 3-day battle that resulted in more than 50,000 casualties. Nearly 8,000 men died in battle, many more from wounds and resulting disease. Those were American lives lost. Is that what secession mongers want for their loved ones and neighbors? But the greater lesson started long before the Civil War. It began when Southern landowners who attended church and quoted the Bible held other human beings captive, ripped husbands from wives and mothers from babies, and forced them into hard labor, even though they and their forebears were guilty of nothing. Yet as they lived their lives a continent away, they were seized by mercenaries and profiteers, shackled in ships, and sold at auctions like cattle in America. Resentment of the federal government has metastasized far beyond the Confederacy and is as oxymoronic as professing Christians enslaving their fellow human beings. Despite the talk of secession, Texas, like many states, is a major federal funding recipient and expects federal disaster aid when hit with catastrophes such as monster tornadoes and devastating wildfires. Now, 150 years after Gettysburg, our country seems like anything but a United States of America. Now, some people claim to be more American than others. Some say they are real Americans, as if others aren't. Some wrap themselves in and display the U.S. flag on everything in sight, as if to prove that they are more patriotic than Americans who don't. Unless Civil War reenactments and other commemorations start emphasizing the relevant lessons of that conflict, including its origins and realistic consequences, today's hate-filled, self-righteous, and self-interested polarization could lead this country down the same kind of disastrous path the Civil War took it, and might already be doing so. To thrive or even survive as a nation, instead of hyping differences and divisions, Americans need to resist being the divided states in America and strive to be a true United States of America.
Lake Effect essayist Gerianne Hazlett is a writer and former journalist and court information officer. She lives in South Milwaukee with her husband and is the author of the book Anatomy of a Trial, Public Loss, Lessons Learned from the People versus O.J. Simpson. We'll take one last break and then we'll shift gears to the spiritual realm and ask some big questions about the afterlife. That's coming up on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio, I'm Bonnie North. Few things are as mysterious to us as the existence of an afterlife. At the same time, the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life found that 75% of Americans believe in an afterlife, 50% believe strongly. Proving it, however, tends to be the job of religions and with some personal testimony. Typically, people in science and medicine don't cross into that realm. Well, enter Dr. Eben Alexander III. He's a neurosurgeon who claims to have had an afterlife experience during a 7-day coma, something he would have previously discounted, or at least questioned, in the experiences of some of his near-death patients. He's written a book about his experiences and about the scientific community's position on the afterlife, or more to the point, its lack of answers, in Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. He'll talk about that book tonight in Milwaukee, but in this interview that first aired in March, he tells Lake Effect's Dan Harmon about the coma.
In November 2008, very suddenly, I went deep into coma from an inexplicable illness, a very rare bacterial meningitis called E. coli meningitis. It drove me into coma within hours. And in fact, when I got to the emergency room, I was already deep in coma with seizures and basically went in there with about a 10% chance of even living through that illness. And during the week, I did not respond to antibiotics. And my neurologic picture, which was grim at the beginning, went quickly down to no function of the brain or cortex, just some primitive brainstem functions, all that's left, so that by the 7th day of that coma, I was down to 2 or 3% chance of survival with no chance of full recovery. And then to shock of all those taking care of me and my family, I started to come back, and they took me off the ventilator, and I made a full and complete recovery within probably 2 or 3 months. Which was inexplicable from a medical standpoint. And then I had to explain this incredible odyssey that I had deep within coma.
Yeah, what was that odyssey?
Well, it was something that before my coma, if you'd asked me how much would such a patient that ill with a severe bacterial meningitis, how much would they remember, I would have told you nothing. So, in fact, I remembered so much when I was first waking up at a time when I remembered nothing of my life before coma, that it was an absolute surprise to remember that much of a hyper-real odyssey. I describe it in detail in my book, kind of in a nutshell. It involved the initial awareness of what I call the earthworm's eye view, which was a very primitive, kind of boiling mud, underground, coarse, and unresponsive realm, but then rescued from that by the slowly spinning white light into a brilliant, verdant valley filled with flowers and blossoms that would open even as we went by. I had no body awareness at the time, but I was as a speck on a butterfly wing. And, of course, it's not an earthly butterfly at all. It's really just the best word I can use to describe it. and millions of other butterflies, the beautiful girl beside me who ended up being crucial in my final understanding of all this months later, and then this sense of the love and divine awareness and presence of that divine creator that permeated every bit of that. And then going from that, what I call the gateway realm, that had earthly trappings, although it also had choirs of angels above and that kind of beautiful thing, leaving that and going into what I call the core, which is outside of higher dimensional space and time, outside of higher dimensional multiverse, with that all-loving deity, that all-powerful and infinitely knowing God at the core of it all, and this brilliant orb of light where I was told, you are not here to stay, you'll be going back. And, of course, I had no clue what that meant because I had complete amnesia for my life before coma, which was a crucial part of my journey. And the experience there, ultra-real, beyond description, beyond earthly knowing, you don't see with the eyes and hear with the ears, experiences much more complete and conceptual flow. But then I would fall from that realm back into the earthworm, my view, that very coarse, monotonous, unresponsive realm. And I learned that by recalling the notes of the melody that was there with that spinning white light, it would come back to me, and that spinning light would open up again as a portal into that gateway, the beautiful valley, with a lovely girl beside me on the butterfly wing, all the unconditional love that was shown there, and then back outside of this universe, the core, that beautiful but infinitely black, filled with love, and also, though, filled, paradoxically enough, with the light of that brilliant orb, taught more lessons about love, the nature of evil, about our purpose for existence, about consciousness throughout the universe, and so many other lessons. And in fact, much of that I could not even go into even in this book, but I am busy writing book two. But then coming back to this realm, and realizing how important love was for it all, and being shocked by that ultra-reality, which is what left me with a real conundrum that I had to explain.
Let me just ask you a skeptical question, and you put on your doctor's hat here for a moment, which is, you go into this in the book, which is the idea that what you experienced could not have been a dream, just because you say that your cortex region was completely non-functional during your coma, if I'm getting that right.
Right.
So is it possible you could have had a dream before and after, and or after your cortex went blank, before it just shut down? Is it possible you could have had a dream before that, and because your cortex was non-functional during that 7 days, that it may have just seemed like you hadn't woke up?
Well, in fact, I can tell you that when I first awoke from this, of course, I did not remember my previous life, didn't remember everything I had known about consciousness, neurosurgery, but I remembered this incredible odyssey that I had just been through in great detail. And I went through a period of about 36 hours after I woke up from coma, after the breathing tube was removed, where I was in and out of a psychotic, delusional nightmare that was filled with language, very different from the ultra-real, pure conceptual flow that I experienced in the gateway and the core deep in the middle of coma. And that's a very important distinction, because the psychotic nightmare that happened after I came out of coma, but was kind of in and out of delusion, as I said, it was like a real nightmare, but it was so different from the crisp, ultra-real conceptual flow deep in coma. It was obviously something different. It had a lot of language, and it was something that happened in my brain. And initially, I lumped all this together, and I was just trying to explain the hyper-real experience deep in coma as a neuroscientist, explain it, you know, as how hyper-reality can occur deep in coma, and especially and surprisingly in a coma where the neocortex has been completely wrecked by meningitis, because that would disable any kind of dream or hallucination by having the neocortex as wrecked as it was by this severe and this prolonged case of meningitis. The other important thing is, towards the very end of my coma journey, there were six faces that I saw. Those faces are very important at timing when most of my coma journey occurred. because they were five faces of people who were there in the last 15 hours of my coma leading up to that Sunday morning, the seventh day when I finally awoke. And then the sixth of those was a woman who was never physically there in the room, but she had come to me. She was a friend of my wife's and had written a book called Third Eye Open, and she had channeled to me. Now, I had no idea what channeling was. I didn't believe in any such thing before my coma, but I knew she was there when I started to wake up, and I told my wife about everything that was happening, that Susan had been there. And she came on the fourth and fifth nights of my coma. So basically, the appearance of those six faces told me that the vast coma experience occurred between days one and five, when, in fact, my brain was soaking in pus. There was no way I was having any kind of conscious experience at all. And that was shocking because as I recovered, I was trying to explain how could that happen given the severity of my meningitis when I should have had no experience whatsoever. So in a nutshell, there's no way it was hallucination.
I'd like to move on past the medical, or even if people believe it or not. I think people can choose whether they or not they want to believe it. And I'm in some ways asking you to become a spiritual interpreter here, but I mean, I know that people want to know some of these things, which are questions about afterlife in general, and some are specific. But the first question that pops to mind, and these are kind of spiritual questions, but you describe this world as the afterlife or the other life, which is a word I'm superimposing here. But if it's so wonderful, and the way you describe it in the book, it is, then do you have any sense of what we're doing here? I mean, because things are on Earth are quite different and not pleasant a lot of times. And
yes, it has everything to do with the purpose of our higher souls ascending in that outer realm. This is what I would call soul school. This is where we get the hard work done on this side of the veil, where we're not privy to all the knowing of our existence that we have between lives when we're on that other side of the veil, which is what you see in near-death experiences, but can also glimpse through centering prayer and deep meditation. And in fact, our souls are yearning to get down into this very imperfect realm with all of its evil and injustice, because this is where they actually get the work done. And, you know, so much of that was very clear to me in coming back from my journey. Hmm. And I really have very little doubt about it now. I'm just trying to put together all the details of how it works. But that purpose is quite clear.
Now, you described before your coma that you were a religious man. How does this experience jibe with, A, your religious beliefs and maybe what you see as current religion? Because I could see your experience contradicts some religious beliefs, or at least what has turned into some religious beliefs, and other concepts. You use the words om and love, but you would never use the word sin. So maybe you can capsulize what happened to you and where do you think our culture is there.
Right. I grew up with a father who was very religious and very scientific, and for him there was never a conflict. He was an academic neurosurgeon. He had a strong faith in God. For me as a youth, science was the arbiter of truth. I wanted to believe in God and heaven and prayer as I was young, but through my life I lost that faith, and then as I describe in the book, I had a rejection by my birth mother in the year 2000 that really crushed any last hope for a loving personal God, any last hope in a belief in prayer. And that's the way I was for 8 years before my coma. Of course, my coma changed everything. I totally know and believe completely in that all-loving God at the very core of all existence, all-powerful, all-knowing, and very personal inside each and every one of us, and know that to the extent that any religion discusses an all-loving God and that we're all brothers and sisters in this together and are here to take care of all of our fellow beings, not just humans, but all of our fellow beings on Earth, and show compassion and forgiveness, then those aspects of that religion are consistent. Any aspect of a religion that says we're the only religion, we're the true religion, the rest of them are false, you know, and is putting up conflict and setting up antagonism between people, that is all dysfunctional human thinking. It has nothing to do with the message from that all-powerful, all-loving God who loves all of God's children. And so, to me, religion is very much straightforward, as much as it is consistent with that all-loving, that we are here to love and care and show compassion and forgiveness. Any of the other teachings are not coming from prophets or mystics at all, and are not consistent with that all-powerful God that I saw, and that I think so many other near-death experiencers have seen, a very similar God. And in fact, for me, going back to religious mystic writings, going back thousands of years, it's clear that we are all talking about the very same heaven and the very same God. But we get all bogged down in the crazy details of dogma.
It seems like, without saying it, but what you just said and your book is separating spirituality from religion, and of course is not your new concept. I mean, there's a lot of people that would ascribe to that. Is that something that you think is reinforced in your experience?
I would say that spirituality and understanding the power of that all-knowing and all-powerful, all-loving God is every bit of my story and other near-death stories, and really a part of the truest forms of all religion. The thing that gets religions in trouble, just like gets kind of modern materialist science in trouble, is when people are addicted to beliefs and they hang on to them without kind of paying attention to the larger picture. And it's those beliefs, those dogmatic beliefs, whether they're in religion or in science, you know, addiction to scripture is the final word. Of course, the problem with scripture is you can find contradictions everywhere. I think that is a message that many people resonate with at this point, and it is certainly one that I appreciate. I still go to a Christian church, an Episcopal church. I enjoy praying with others, but I also know very clearly, I have no doubt whatsoever, that God loves Christians, Jews, Muslims, atheists, skeptics. God loves all of God's creation, and anyone who is telling me otherwise is not consistent with what I saw on my journey.
Well, Dr. Alexander, your book was very thought-provoking, I have to say. So thank you very much for coming on.
Well, thank you very much.
Dr. Eben Alexander's book is called Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife. It's published by Simon & Schuster. He first spoke with Dan Harmon in March, and he'll appear tonight at Boswell Book Company. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.